Welcome to the Yacht Rock Show with your captain, Eddie Gantz, with First Mate Joe Carlisle and Samir at the wheel. And here's your host, Eddie Gantz.
So, folks, I want to welcome everyone to the Yacht Rock Show. And again, this is another very, very special show for Joe and I. Why do I say this? Because I've got another one of my heroes on board tonight. I'm talking about Mr. Steve Percaro from Toto. We want to welcome him. Steve, how are you? And welcome to the Yacht Rock Show.
Hey, thanks, guys. I'm doing real well. Real well, thank you. I go as far as to say I'm grooving. And thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, man. Our pleasure. So first of all, I got to jump in and ask you the crazy question. The Yacht Rock craziness, what do you think of it? When did you hear about it? Give me your thoughts.
Are you embracing it?
Are you embracing it, hating it?
You mean just this whole Yacht Rock thing in general?
Yeah, the whole genre that they made
up. You know, it's funny, to be real honest with you. I have some mixed feelings. First of all, it's great that so much of the stuff we worked on over the years is being... People are recognizing it and finding, I don't care if it's a guilty pleasure or whatever they want to call it, that people are discovering this, you know, genre, if you will, that just makes them feel good and that they like. To be honest with you, it may surprise some listeners, even though, believe me, a lot of the music that I've written or I've been part of or even in the band Toto is definitely fits right into the definition of yacht rock. There's a lot that when I listen to it now, I kind of have mixed feelings. It a lot of it feels. A great song is a great song, and yeah. But a lot of it feels like way overproduced for me and real. You know what I mean? We used to defend our slickness. As a band and any music that was slick that we spent that much hours making as good as we possibly could, we used to defend it, you know what I mean, adamantly and stuff. Yeah. But now I listen to some stuff, and I know why, believe me, especially a guy like me who spent tons of hours, you know, belaboring such sections of songs to make it as perfect as I could. I wish some of this stuff was looser. I wish some of it had a little more, you know what I'm saying?
I wish, sure.
A little more organic or something.
Yeah. And if I'm being honest, I hope I'm not pissing everybody off right now you know what I mean? There's a lot of it I hear. And to be honest, it just kind of leaves me. I wish some of this stuff was just a little bit looser. A little bit looser in that that it sounded like the guys were having a little more fun on the sessions. Mm. I had the opportunity to be on some of these sessions, and I would see when, especially it was Lukather and my brother Jeff, and you know, especially the guys in Toto, how good they were, how really good they were at what they did, and just those first passes sometimes.
There's magic in a first pass sometimes.
There was magic in a first pass there, and it being, you know what I mean? I know for guys like us, when I listen back or when it's, you know, when the music's judged from a distance, being tight, being in tune, being perfect wasn't the problem. You know what I mean? That was never... I just sometimes think our priorities. I sometimes wish, and I can talk about myself now. I wish I spent more time on the lyrics than I did on the bass drum sound. You know what I mean? Speaking for myself.
Wow.
You know what I mean? There's aspects we still would have spent. You got to understand. I'm speaking for ourselves. We just loved being in the studio so much. We had so much fun being in the studio, especially when you're surrounded by guys like my brother Jeff. It was so much fun to record.
I can imagine.
You know, we loved doing what we did so much. I just wish there was even more of it is kind of what I'm thinking about. You know what I'm saying? I wish we spent half the time on some of this stuff and had twice as much music to be talking about. How's that?
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
Sounds like you redeemed yourself with the lyric writing, though, with stuff like that recently, like The Little Things. Can't get enough of that tune.
Oh, we love that.
Love that tune.
Oh, you're very sweet to say that. Yeah, I mean, all of us. Believe me, I know all of the guys have been trying real hard. I mean, I know the, you know, this look at the song Africa was David Paich trying really hard to bring more to the table lyrically than we had in the past, you know. But the truth was, for the most part, and this is a real generality, and I'm talking about our band, you know, we would typically spend, you know, it could be days on a drum sound, and a lot of the lyrics were written the night before we had to do the vocals because the song was being mixed the next day or something.
Right.
So just priorities. We're such musos. We love the studio so much. We love recording so much. We loved each other's company so much, and we're having so much fun. We had no problem spending that much time on what we did.
Cool. Yeah, we know that feeling, right, Joe?
Yeah. I mean, not at that level, but when you're in the studio, hours and hours, days could go by.
Yeah, and again, I kind of feel like I'm talking out of school a little bit. I can. It's funny because I can point this at myself by all means, and but when I listen to a lot of stuff, if I'm real honest with you, there's a certain level of the slickness, which while I appreciate it, it leaves me a little cold. But we were all just aspiring to greatness.
Yeah, but you don't want to just attribute that to the sound of the time. You know, you were doing something for a certain period, and that was then, and now you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not. I wouldn't kick myself over it, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Please.
We're certainly not disappointed, that's for sure.
I'm just being real honest.
Yeah.
In looking back at some of that stuff, and when I hear a lot of the stuff that is under the category of yacht rock,
yeah, you know.
Do you have a favorite album? Is that a possibility? If somebody asks you, what's your favorite Toto album? Is that, could you say, yeah, it's this one? Boom.
Toto album, sure. Toto 4 was when kind of. You know, my brother Mike had a saying, and he used this in many, many different situations, but the groove is a delicate thing, you know? Whether you're actually talking about the groove in music or whether you're actually talking about the way a band is getting along, you know what I'm saying? You can use that phrase a million different ways, but with Toto 4, it felt like we're all on the same page or running on all cylinders, and it didn't get too far. I was able to kind of finally show the guys the difference between me doing a session for David Foster or Quincy Jones and doing three songs in an afternoon, which I did often and felt I was actually good at. That's why they hired me. And the difference between that and when I would spend a few days on something where I was able to be left alone and experiment and write things out and do all the things that you couldn't or I didn't have time to do on a session, you know.
Right.
And not speaking for myself, you know, the guys would walk in there and believe me, Luca III then and before and to this day, he didn't need to spend a few days. you know what I mean? It just was there immediately. That's why he's got the body of work he does. My brother Jeff, you know what I'm saying? First or second pass, you're getting, you know what I mean?
Done.
You were getting this stuff.
Right.
With and really the same goes for everyone in the band. Me, I've always liked to think of myself as, yeah, I could think on my feet, especially with another keyboard player like David Paich next to me or David Foster or whoever it was in the studio. I could think on my feet and be real fast. But if I had more time, if I could write out that string arrangement like the way I, you know what I mean, knew how to do as opposed to just making it up in my head you know, doing it real fast like we had to do on sessions, it would be better if I, you know what I mean, if I could experiment and try things that I normally wouldn't wouldn't have the cojones to do in a session because it would take too long and it might not work out, you know? Right. But with Toto 4, I felt I was able to show the guys, like with the Rosanna solo and with other stuff, you know, what I could do if I had the time.
Yeah, you're definitely Toto's mad scientist.
Yeah.
More than once, Luke had mentioned that they'd be doing something else and you'd be locked away somewhere, you know, just going nuts on something, you know, while they did their parts and split, and then, not that you needed to, but you wanted to.
Yeah. But that was it, though. I wanted to bring, quite frankly, I just wanted to bring what I brought to the table up to their level. You know what I mean? And I didn't do that by just walking in and blowing a great solo or whatever. I did that by having the time to experiment.
Was there a favorite? I know you probably have every keyboard that's existed, like the Prophet 10 or Jupiter 8 and all that stuff. Was there a favorite one, a go-to, a Mini Moog?
Yeah, there absolutely was. It's funny you say that. You know, Mini Moog was one of those go-to guys. And also, especially back in the day, the Yamaha CS80 was really – and it was really – I had just gotten a CS80 when Toto started. So, wow. And it was this big, huge polyphonic new synthesizer that had just come out, and I was dying to have one. And there was this huge waiting list here in L.A. for one. Uh-huh. It was going to take like 9 months to a year. Only one store distributed them, and it was going to take over 9 months. You had to leave at least $1,000 deposit. And thank God my brother Mike happened to be in Japan with Larry Carlton. And he said, Steve, he called me one day.
You're a dime a dozen
said,
over
Steve,
here.
Steve, they're all over the place. They're in they're in every window of every music store here. Wow. You know, want one?
So he shipped one home
for
you? And he shipped one home. Wow. And you know what I'm saying? And that's, first of all, the kind of guy Mike was. And he knew how bad I wanted it. And I had one. And that was all over the first album, all over quite a few of the albums, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And it really felt like an axe. And it's funny because it never had MIDI. And that was one of those classic examples, guys, of where the technology gets to a place, right? After MIDI was there for a while, by 82, 83, after we had done the fourth album, it kind of, the CS80 kind of became obsolete. It was like the only thing in the room that didn't have MIDI, didn't transmit it, and didn't take it, so it wound up getting sidelined. But then it's like one of those things for synth players where you kind of go, wait a minute, that was my axe, the way I knew it backwards and forwards, the way I slapped it around live, for lack of a better term. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You really start realizing after the fact, hey, wait a minute, I really, what happened to my axe? There was something about that was that I actually had a bond with, you know.
How did it become a buzz amongst keyboard players? Who first came out? Who first started using it? And everybody started saying, "Oh, did you hear that Yamaha thing?"
You know what? It was like I said. There was one at there was this music store. It used to be on Beverly Boulevard in L.A. David Abel Music. They had a guy there, Clark Spangler, who was doing a lot of work in the studios and stuff. He was actually using one on film scores. Going along with my dad, I had seen it. I had heard about it. I went there one day and put headphones on, and there was this brass. It was like two synths built into one, so it already had this big, thick sound. And there was just this preset, brass one, and on the other side was brass two. And you could detune a little bit. And when I played it, it was like, oh, this is what like a polyphonic Moog is supposed to sound like. You know what I mean? Moog had come out with a poly Moog, but it did not sound like a polyphonic Mini Moog. It didn't sound like 8 Mini Moogs at all. Huh. It sounded pretty horrible to me at the time. You know what I mean? That particular synthesizer. And this sounded fat and huge, and it had this polyphonic aftertouch. It just had this humanity about it. You know what I mean? Every note was slightly different. And, you know, I brought Paige over there as soon as I could, and he heard it. And we all just, you know what I mean? That was one of those ones that was like, I want this now, you know?
I'm sure over the years those companies
had to have it.
Those companies have probably tapped you for like consulting and stuff like that, right? Over the years, Roland or Oberheim or Moog.
Yeah, you know, at first, you know, that's how I got in with Yamaha. Was, you know, it was very funny, very weird, because that CS80 was from Japan. It wound up having problems, and that first one I called Yamaha, they just sent me to my factory authorized service center, and when I brought it to those guys to fix it, you know what I mean? They did five more. There were five more things wrong with it than before I brought it to them. So I got these guys on the phone, and they let me bring it in to them in Buena Park. And I kept bringing it in. They said, we'll get it working once for you, and then you're on your own. Ooh. And I just kept bringing it in. I would do sessions with Foster. We'd use it a lot, and something would happen to it. And I, you know, it was a very finicky, very, very tough synth, at least in those real early days, to keep it in tune, to keep it maintained. And I got to know it so well. I was able to show them, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I don't know, it's just kind of not working sometimes. I could be very specific and show them, and they were kind of impressed with how obsessed I was, I think.
Oh, cool.
And in those days, they started asking me about stuff, but once they started with all the digital stuff, it kind of went beyond me showing them what to do, you know what I mean?
Right.
And even later on, when I started getting into, when they started having sequencers you know, software like that. You know, I used to spend a whole lot of time where I'd stop what I was doing and go, man, they've got to have this feature. And I'd stop and write it down. And I'd actually would fill up notebooks with this stuff. But by the time I would send it into these companies, you know, it started a lot more guys who were musicians were using the same stuff and coming to the same conclusions. And they really didn't need me to do that anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, you there know were Eric plenty Persian, of right?
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, I kind of felt like, you know, I'm in the studio a lot. I'm also in a band. I'm also touring. Like, I had a unique perspective that they needed to hear. Well,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
After a while, everybody started having this stuff. And all us musicians just wanted the same thing, for these things to be musical and to make sense, you know?
So working with Foster and doing all these sessions around that time, I'm sure you've encountered the Rhodes E, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
So you played it a bunch of times.
Oh, well, it was just always on the sessions, and Foz would always request that one, and a lot of guys just would request that Rhodes. You know, Andy Leeds, you know, that was Leeds' musical instrument rental.
How do you feel about that Rhodes? Was it really the best Rhodes you'd ever touched?
Yeah, it just was magical.
That's cool.
You know, the sound, the amount of tine, the attack. It just, every Rhodes was a little different. I had a Rhodes 88 and still have it, by the way. And mine was always kind of mushy and, you know, it was always kind of mushy. And then I went and had it. One thing you could do is to kind of have it, have the tines, have the, I'm sorry, not the tines, but the dampers like doped so it would have a harder sound.
Hmm.
And they totally overdid it when they did mine. And, you know what I mean? Again, the groove's a very delicate thing. And at first it was underdone, then it was overdone. And the E was just like a magic, you know, was one that just was kind of perfect. You know,
there's a plugin now, actually. I think they developed a plugin.
Yeah.
Who's the new owner? The Greek guy, George Castadema, whatever.
Did he? I know. I think Jay Graydon was involved in that.
Jay Graydon was involved in that. That's right. But it's a cool one. I wonder if you encountered that. Did you get that yet? Or
I didn't get it because, you know, I'm not that. I'm trying to, as much as I love that Rhodes sound, the work that Spectrasonics has done with this, with their plugin called Keyscape.
Oh, Keyscape,
and stuff.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. It's great.
It kind of gets close enough for me. And I'm as much as, believe me, I wouldn't mind having it, and I'm sure it would be fun to listen to it and to have it, and it's very special. I'm trying to look forward and do some new sounds, and
right,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
That's kind of been done, you know?
Speaking of new sounds, let's talk about the album, Ed, the solo album.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
So that was 2016. You did Someday, Someway was your solo album, right?
Yeah, it was a while ago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, It's still great, still beautiful. We played some of the stuff, right? Didn't you play the? I think Eddie played the tune that Michael McDonald sings on.
Or oh, sure, he sang on a couple of things.
Yeah, he's on at least. Yeah.
Yep, he was very kind to do that. You know, he was very
kind. There's the one track that your brothers are playing on. Am I right?
Yeah, that was actually a Toto. You know, that was something I was submitting for Toto. It was just kind of started off as a synth jam that I did with a drum machine. And I had brought it to Toto at some point and re-recorded it. So I, you know, there was a Jeff drum track on there. And I think that was, and Mike was in the band then too. And Mike did a bass part. So I just, you know, we had so many slaves made in those days. I got my hands on, it never wound up on a Toto album. Lyrics were never finished. A vocal was never on there. And so I just kind of, I really didn't ask anyone's permission. I just kind of went in there and grabbed it and threw it on my solo album, you know. I grabbed Jeff's drum part, I grabbed Mike's bass part, and I finished the rest of it, you know, just in my own studio. And, you know, the guys were kind enough not to sue me.
How old were those tracks? Were they from, like, 86?
Oh, boy.
Because I know you guys had, like, stuff from the Fahrenheit sessions, and you put them on 14.
Good,
isn't that right?
Good question. Yeah, good. Exactly. Might have been around then. Something like that.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't anything any of the other guys missed. It wasn't anything any of the other guys ever talked about. Like, oh, yeah, remember, right. You know, remember that tune at all. So I felt pretty good about just grabbing it and throwing it on my solo album.
So we were talking
Go ahead. Well, I gotta ask you. This is complete. Sure. It's off the subject. But whose idea was it to put Steve Porcaro on the Hydra cover?
That was Jeff's. That was completely
really?
Jeff's idea. Yeah, absolutely.
I tell you, you look really mad cool in there. I must admit.
Really? Thanks. Yeah, I was a very strange photo shoot, and yeah, I was working real hard in those days. Yeah,
that's
and poor
shot.
Jim Hagopian. David had a girlfriend at the time. David Page's girlfriend was Gail Hagopian, and her brother Jim did a lot of our photography and did all the photography on Hydra. And when we did the cover shoot, you know, he had all this. It was just him by him. I don't even think he had an assistant with him. It was just the two of us. But he did have, I think he had rented like a remote flash. So that when he was taking the picture, the flash from inside this tunnel would automatically flash, and he couldn't get it to work. And he was so it was funny because I was very tired. I'd been up working for a long time, and he was so, what I remember about the photo shoot, he was so apologetic that this thing was screwing up, and I couldn't have been more understanding. Being a guy who dealt with technology that especially in those days would malfunction at the worst possible moment, like when all the guys were there. So if you look on the back album cover, you could see the wire coming from the on the bottom of the picture, the wire that was hooked up from the flash to the camera because his remote flash wouldn't work. And we gave up and just hooked the wire up.
That's cool. Very cool. I also love the story behind A Secret Love.
Yeah, you know, that whole beginning part of A Secret Love is really, you know, when I talk about experimenting and stuff, that's sure one that didn't come out. You know what I mean? I kind of wish I had that. I wish I could remove that from the you know, from the master that they make the CDs out of or whatever. That was, it was an experiment. I had just gotten all the modular stuff, and it just was something that didn't come out. You know what I mean? Now, the rest of Secret Love, I'm very proud of. And the very end, the end tape loop at that end Secret Love, I'm very proud of that stuff.
And the vocal was phenomenal, correct?
Yeah, you know, the vocal was, I'd been working on the song. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I knew I didn't want, you know, again, it was my thing with Toto where I couldn't really sing it. I knew I didn't want Lukather to sing it. His voice was, you know, had too much of a certain kind of sound. I knew I didn't want Bobby on it. Bobby's big, kick-ass kind of vocal. I did not want that on it. And right. Bobby just happened to be at the studio. I was working like crazy on it at this guy's home studio who had a Chamberlain. And, you know, it was really, the track was really taking shape. I was really excited about it. You know, there's a whole story of how we cut the initial track at Sunset Sound. But anyway, I just went to go run an errand. And Bobby said, "Hey, do you mind if I take a stab at this?" And I was like, "Okay, but you know what I mean. I would have bet a lot of money that I wasn't going to use what he did." But I got to tell you, I came home. And he had done the entire lead vocal. He had done all those background parts. And I had never heard Bobby sing like that in my life. And wow. And I haven't heard him sing like that since, yeah. Honestly. And it just, he just blew my mind. You know what I mean?
What a great story. Yeah. Is there a serious, like, why wasn't Mike Porcaro in the band from the beginning?
You know, it's a good question. You know, I think mostly because Toto came up. You know, Paige would be better one to answer this question. But it was mostly because the way I saw it is that David Paich, my brother Jeff, and David Hungate had become such a section. You know what I mean? Like the section. You know what I mean?
But the
three of them were getting hired so much together. Mike was busy. Mike was doing sessions and doing his thing. But those three guys, you know, after the Seals and Croft stuff and then a whole lot of other sessions, and then especially Silk Degrees, you know what I mean? Which is really kind of, you know what I mean? The real start of Toto, Lowdown. That's those three guys. And, yeah, if there was as much nepotism as you might think there would be, you know, and for just Groove Factor, you would have thought right away we would start with Mike. And a lot of people think he's my little brother because he came after the fact, but not at all. Mike was between Jeff and I, but it just, you know, this was Paich putting together his dream band and Jeff as well. And Hungate was the guy from the beginning.
Interesting.
You know what I'm saying? He was that guy. They had this certain chemistry. Not that there wasn't chemistry with Mike, but those three were like were really something super special. And I think Paich always kind of started out with that nucleus. The rest of us were question marks, you know, who the guitar player was going to be, you know.
Right.
I think David saw me. He knew he wanted to he knew synths were, you know what I mean, were going to be big, and he already had an interest in them and saw how much further I would go down the rabbit hole than he would ever want to. And seriously, and I knew at the time, and I at the time I was a band member. You know, they saw me play with Gary Wright and saw you know what I mean? Just that synth thing. And I was there to, you know, and I didn't have much of an ego as a player and was happy to program for David Paich. It was an honor to, it was like as a keyboard player, it was like having this big bully brother behind you all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would, some of my own songs I would show, I go, "David, look," kind of like what you heard about, I wound up hearing later, like what Fagan would do, where he would just have, You know, he knew what the keyboard, he knew what he wanted for a piano part. He knew exactly what he wanted. He wrote the tune. He's a piano player. But yet, what would he do? He would have it written out and have Michael Omardian execute it, you know?
Right.
You know what I mean? It was the same with me. I'd show Paich. I'd go, "Look, here's the piano part I'm doing. Execute this as far as a performance went and playing it." You know what I mean? I had no problem. There was no ego for me as a player. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I just wanted my song, you know what I mean? My song executed, performed as good as possible.
Yeah. So, Ed, you want to talk about the elephant in the room? I know you're busting. You want to ask about that one special song. Go ahead. Well, unleash it. He's dying. Yeah, he's been waiting, too. I'm sure.
The thing is, I mean, human nature. That song, you didn't sit down and say, "All right, I'm writing a song for Michael Jackson." Am I right? That's not how that went down.
Okay. Not at all. Never in a million years. Wow. As a matter of fact, you know, we were working with Quincy, and I'll shut up in a second, but the direction, Quincy was really going to Paige. Paige was the, you know, was the famous songwriter in the room, and what he was asking for was something like My Sharona, you know.
Really?
Oh yeah. You know, which wound up being Beat It. You know what I mean? He was looking for a simple rock thing for Michael. You know what I mean?
Really? Wow. So
that was the instruction. You know, any of the writers that were, you know, and I wasn't even considered, you know what I mean? I wasn't really even considered. I was a synth programmer, you know.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
In Quincy's eyes.
So doesn't the story go that it was on a cassette and you had rewound the cassette or something? It was at the end of something?
Yeah,
and you had forwarded or rewound it to a certain point, Quincy would have never heard it.
Yeah, we bought cassettes by the case, but I had just thrown Human Nature down on, you know, I'd thrown my version of, you know, my demo, which you can go online and hear if you Google Human Nature demo.
Right.
I had just thrown it down, and Paige called down to me. David had been – Quincy was actually sending a runner to David's studio like almost every day. Like, what do you got? Have you come up with something to submit? And I was – you know what I mean? I was kind of a studio manager, so to speak. That's how I paid David back for, you know, him letting me have the run of the place. And he had done a couple grooves the night before. He had thrown down just – a couple grooves, and lo and behold, he called down to me saying, the runner's on his way, you know, put those two things on cassette for me. And there were no more cassettes. I had just used the last one. So I just, you know, took off the stickers. I rewound it so that side B would be blank tape, and put the sticker on it and put A on that side. Recorded David's two things, and honestly didn't, you know, the guy picked it up, and that's the last I heard of it. And then the next day, for David to take over the story, David said, you know, Quincy called him and was going on and on about this tune. He said they were talking for 20 minutes on the phone, and Quincy's talking about this Why song, and it took David, he told me it took him 20 minutes for him to realize that he was talking about a different song than either one of his, that he was talking about Human Nature, you know. Right. Quincy on one of the Thriller, like the Thriller, I don't know, 25th anniversary or whatever, they have these little snippets of audio of interviews of Quincy.
I
listened to one of those, and Quincy said on it that, you know, he had heard the way he described it. He heard this tape that you know, the Toto guys, quote unquote, it was just Paige, had submitted. And he said he let it go. And then all of a sudden he heard this, why? And he thought that's the ticket. Well, so I kind of came to the conclusion that what must have happened was that auto reverse must have kicked in.
Right. I remember hearing that.
And I'm pretty sure Quincy has confirmed that since then. You know what I mean? That Quincy just let it go and was going about his business in his office doing whatever. And the tape reached the end. And when it went to the other side, he heard Human Nature.
God bless auto reverse.
So Steve, right? Man, you must have come on. You must have freaked out when they said that song is going on the Thriller album. Am I right?
Oh yeah. Oh absolutely.
Oh my God, that's insane.
Just that he was interested at all, I was blown away. Like I said, he was asking for a My Sharona kind of tune. I just was doing
My Sharona,
one of my typical mid tempo ballads. I didn't think it was anything that special, to tell you the truth. You
well, I consider it genius.
Yeah. Well, they're all
that's
special.
Very sweet of you. Thank you very much.
It's genius, my friend. Genius.
You know, I've got to say every time I talk about it now that, you know, I remember we cut the track. Everything was going good. Quincy was really digging it. And he called. I was on the road with Toto. He called and asked me for lyrics. And I was on the back of the bus and I completed my lyrics. The chorus was exactly the chorus you hear, you know, that wound up on the record. And, you know, when we got back off the road, Quincy asked me, he says, do you mind if I have someone else take a stab at the verses? And again, having no ego as a lyricist, I was like, absolutely. I mean, I dug my title. I know Quincy loved the title too. Uh-huh. And I think dug the chorus, but you know, my verse lyrics were horrible, you know, so I've got to bring up John Bettis, who really,
right,
with that kind of narrative and punched waking up and going to, you know what I mean? And
yeah, like a Randy Goodrum type of writer, correct?
You know what I'm saying? A real, right, lyricist. Human nature, right, wouldn't be the song it became. You know, there again is your difference between a record and a song. And John Bettis really made it a song. You know what I'm saying? And
sure.
You know what I mean? I just was, again, talk about the stars aligning and Quincy's production and Bruce Swedeen's engineering and Michael's performance. He was just singing it the first or second time I was in the room with him, feeding him each line, you know, how the phrasing went, you know. And it just, yeah. And it was real cool because, you know, when they were mixing, you know, no one was in the studio with Bruce Swedeen except his second engineer, including Quincy. You know, that was the way really they worked. And I was in another studio working on, I think, The Lady of My Life, or another one of Rod's tunes we were doing last minute overdubs on, synth stuff on, when Bruce was mixing Human Nature. And I was in there with Humberto, and Quincy went in to hear Human Nature, and they called me in. I mean, you know, no songwriter got called in or whatever, you know. Quincy called me in because he insisted that the vocal, the slaps, the echoes, not the reverb, but the slaps on the vocal were just like my demo. He loved the way I did it on my demo, and they had me recreate it, you know, for the mix. And that wound up being a thing. You know, no one was in this room with Bruce Swedeen. He was such a master, and Bruce was so cool and love to remind me about that for, you know what I mean, for years to come after, how cool that was, how we set up those slaps that way. And then the song was done. You know?
And I know that Human Nature probably paid for a few college funds, correct?
It continues to.
Continues.
My college
funds. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah, no, it's
sampled
that's awesome
over the years. And
it's
even
been
like,
very good. It's been very good to
John
me.
John Mayer did that great version at the funeral.
There's been many great versions. I'm very blessed, you know.
But you were in
blessed
that loop long before Thriller, right? You were on Off the Wall, and
yep,
then even after that, Bad.
Yeah, thanks to Foster. Thanks to Foster. I worked on, Foster brought me in again to program for him. He had, what, two or three co-writes on Off the Wall. And in those days, if, you know, Quincy called him in to do some keyboards, to do some synthesizers. And, you know, and I would bring my trusted Mini Moog and my trusted CS-80. And, you know, that kind of, you know, then Quincy started calling me on my own, you know what I mean, to do whatever he was doing. I kind of became part of the team, you know, along with Michael Boddicker and some other real talented guys and stuff. And, yeah, I'd been working on Thriller just doing synths, doing synth overdubs, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Oh, it's great stories.
Yeah. So, Ed, you touched on the whole Yacht Rock thing before, and then I wanted to go into, you guys spoke about Africa, how Weezer latched on to Africa. How did you feel when that happened? That happened like right before the Yacht Rock thing exploded, and a whole new legion of young fans a whole new genre just embraced Africa through Weezer. How did that come about?
It just was, it's just one of those things. How do you? None of us, you know, none of us can have it figured out. Luke and I remember. I remember myself, and I remember Luke. And Luke talks about it too. We didn't think Africa should be on Total 4. Okay?
That's crazy.
I'm dead serious. Now I worked my ass off on it because I worked my ass off on everything I did, you know.
Right.
And we did all kinds of experimenting at David's house with the kalimbas, and those were GS1s. Those were these digital synthesizers that Yamaha had came out with that weren't programmable. You couldn't change the sounds that came with it. But because of my clout with Yamaha at the time, we had hooked up with these guys that used to, you know, what they called voiced it. They programmed it. And they came in and got together with us and let us tweak these sounds, those kalimba sounds and stuff at the beginning. I put a lot of work into it. I did all kinds of experimenting with gating stuff and bringing loops in, and I worked my ass off on that song like everything else on Total 4, but I didn't think it should go on the record.
Wow. I love and that. So, the beginning.
And Luke admits this too, for his own reasons.
Yeah, he
didn't think it should have been on the record. And look, it's our only number one ever. So
that's insane.
It helps us keep our humility about the music business and about what works and what doesn't. Anyway, and when all that happened with Weezer, that was kind of right in the middle of this weird surge with Africa. I mean, Weezer had a lot to do with it, but all of a sudden there's this installation in the African desert where they're playing Africa forever and on a loop. And then there's it would be stuff like that, guys. And then even before that, people would send us two guys. I'm sorry, I wish I knew their name, but just two guys like at a pizza shop somewhere or in a restaurant.
Set
up in a corner that just did a kick-ass version of
That's
Africa.
Right. That's right.
You know what I mean?
To do that with two guys is impressive.
Yeah. And it was just like one after another like that. And, and this is when I was in the middle of On the Road with the guys. So, it was great. We were touring like we had a hit record out. You know what I'm saying? At all the casino. Everyone wanted to go see the Africa band,
And then you actually did the cameo with them on Jimmy Kimmel, right? I remember seeing that.
I did.
That was fun.
I did.
That was
and
great.
I was home. Luke was out with Ringo at one point, right at the peak of all that. Africa was actually, I think they had also done Rosanna, and Luke was out with Ringo or whatever. I was home twiddling my thumbs waiting for the next run we were going to do, and I said, come on, we got to return the favor. And so, I did a version of Hash Pipe.
Right.
I found something that Joseph could sing, and Luke just came home, did his part and his solo, and, 3 hours, less than 3 hours or whatever, and we put that out as a one-off, Wow.
So do you think,
I tell you, go ahead.
After the popularity of Africa, do you think that, who penned Stranger in Town? Was that Paich?
Yeah, I think so. There might have been co-written, but as far as I know it was David.
Yeah, that seemed like the heir apparent to the Africa success. Do you feel that
way,
too?
Did it? Yeah. No, and I know we put a lot into it. We put a lot into it. There was a big, very expensive video made for Stranger in Town.
It just seemed like it was on that same tip.
It
like
kind of didn't
off the Africa
take.
Thing.
didn't
I
take.
Loved it, but who's listening to me?
Thanks.
Well, our favorite two albums. Besides four,
our Desert Island Discs.
Desert Island would be Fahrenheit and the seventh one
for sure.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I get that a lot. You hear that a lot from people. I wasn't officially a member on the seventh one. Fahrenheit was my last official album with the guys. I mean, I did a lot of work on the seventh one, and I toured for the seventh one.
Oh.
But that was the first album I wasn't, and I really dug that album too. The way really Joseph really came into his own on that record, and
sure.
I thought it was strong.
What I want to talk about Fahrenheit is actually the track Fahrenheit. The name Amin Bhatia.
Yeah.
For that intro, that cinematic intro you guys had. We were talking about our friend George Manna before. That really grabbed George's ear when that came out. He said, what is going on there? That's why George fell in love with all that stuff. But Amin Bhatia, tell me about Amin Bhatia. What was his contribution? It was like a flash in the pan kind of thing. But
we're still very close friends to this day. I'll tell you what that was. That was... when I'd gotten all the modular stuff on the second album, when we were doing a Hydra, I had gotten Paich was just way, way, way generous. And in those days, there weren't really many polyphonic synthesizers that could do different sounds on different voices. Anyway, we went and got these two huge modular systems. And the idea was to play it from the sequencer. There was this computer sequencer thing Roland made called a microcomposer, and I used a digital sequencer quite a lot in the studio and on all the Toto stuff. It was a very simple monophonic thing I usually used with a mini Moog, and it was very easy to work, it was real effective for me. I used it on everything. And but when I got this thing, it was just like a whole nother level of technology and denseness. And I was in so over my head. I really was struggling and staying up forever, trying to read the manual, which was a, you know what I mean, which was impossible, trying to teach myself this. And there was only a couple guys in town that had it. And I, again, I, you know what I mean? I asked a lot of questions in those days. I wasn't, I was always willing to, you know, to learn, to not, I didn't have to be the one to figure it out. I just wanted to use it.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, long story, you know, it's, I'll try to make this story short. I get a call out of the blue one day while I'm trying to figure this thing out from David Foster. And he says, "Steve, have you heard of a Roland microcomposer?" And I said, "Heard of it. I'm killing myself over this thing as we speak." You know what I mean? I'm working real hard on it. Why? He goes, "Well, the guy who invented it is sitting next to me. He's an old pal of mine from Canada." And I was like, "What?" Anyway, he brings him over, and this guy and I become fast friends. He becomes my new best friend in the world.
How could he not?
Really quick. He was the sweetest guy. His name was Ralph Dyke, and he did the original design of the microcomposer for Roland. And we became fast friends. And David, David and I, and especially out of David's generosity, we would actually fly this guy down from Canada. He'd stay at David's house for weeks at a time, just helping me learn the microcomposer and all that modular stuff, teaching me about it, interfacing it. You know, he could do grab a soldering iron and hook up a foot switch so I could trigger something remotely while I did that. He was just one of these tech guys who made it usable for me. And he actually invented this kind of sync box before anybody did, with a mathematician and with this mathematician in Canada. Anyway, he was this brilliant guy. And anyway, so by this time, David and I, the manor, what we called the manor, which was just David's studio, was, you know, we had two 24 tracks. We had all this modular gear. It was all, it had state of the art, all these Yamaha synths. We
best.
Had everything.
Oh my God.
All right, the best of the best. And Ralph one time comes down. He comes down one time and he says, "Check this out." And he was judging a synthesizer contest that Roland had been running where people would submit a tape. He says, "Check this out." And he plays us this piece of music that just blows me and Paige away. The sounds, the synthesis, the way whoever was doing this was going for this, the musicality, it all was just amazing. And he says, "This is this kid from Canada who did everything we heard with a mini Moog and a four track."
Wow.
Just layering.
Okay. Layering. And I had a four track. I had a four track since I was in junior high school and stuff. I tried layering. It didn't come out like that.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? Now we know the Beatles and Hendrix used four tracks, but those were 3M machines. Those were, you know what I'm saying? And those guys were engineers and had technicians making everything just right. I heard this and it just blew us away. And the way I was then, I was kind of a, you know, I was like, I gotta see this. I gotta see this to believe it. And once again, Ralph hooked us up with the guy, Amin Bhatia. And he was also, David Foster used him on a couple sessions. He did some uncredited work on Thriller, on The Girl Is Mine.
Oh, wow.
That initial glide down, that glassy belly sound down. That was Amin Bhatia.
Oh my God.
Uncredited, you know? Someone, I think Foster, someone had just put it on a piece of tape. Anyway, we flew him down and I set up, right in front of the machine, I set up, I talked to Amin. He says, "Yeah, I just, you know," he says he did that with just a mini Moog and just an EQ and, just a four track. So, we flew him in down, and I set up a mini Moog in front of the speakers with just an EQ next to it and a 24 track. And I was like, "Show me."
Just to see how you do it.
Seriously. Wow. You know what I mean? It had blown my mind so much. And I was like, here I am with all this stuff. And in my opinion, my stuff, synthesis-wise, you know, isn't coming close to what this kid did.
Wow.
And he did it in front of me.
How old is he?
He did it in front of me. He showed me these techniques that he used. Mm-hmm. And it was just absolutely mind-blowing. And I happened to be, right, we happened to be working on Fahrenheit at the time. And I was doing this stuff with Microcomposer. And by the way, if you put your headphones on and listen to the synths on Fahrenheit, the panning stuff I did was, I really spent a lot of time on. And you don't really notice it unless you've got headphones on. But yeah, that was a min. I was like, hey, I've got this thing. I want to do this intro into this song that Jeff, I think that was Jeff and Paige actually, and they had done it with a Linn drum machine. And I says, "Come on, let's do a weird intro into it." And that was a min.
So did he assist you? Did he do it all? What was
he? That was kind of both of us together, but mostly because
even the match at the end. Where's the match coming from? What kind of sample?
That was. I think that was one of our ideas, and believe that I remember recording that match in the vocal booth.
You actually recorded a match. We thought it was a sample. Like one of the first samples.
No. Wow. I had no rules, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right.
Believe me, there were no rules. Amin did have some rules. Amin was really, especially those days, was a pure synthesis kind of guy. But he learned from hanging out with me quick. I wanted to get to the point and stuff like that. Amin's he just won another. He's a very, very successful composer in Canada. Has done many movies and a lot of TV stuff.
Oh,
he's been very successful and thrives to this day, you know.
That's great.
And has remained a real good friend.
Oh, that's great.
So you know what blows me away, that I knew that you guys played on a gazillion albums and stuff like that, but specifically disco, when I heard that you guys were on the group Chanson with David Williams and James Jamerson Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! I was like, "No, you got to be kidding me!" It was "Don't Hold Back." That track is insane. The way Jeff Porcaro and you.
Good?
Oh my God!
You know that particular thing. Those guys were real good friends. David Williams used to hang out at Jeff's house all the time.
Really?
Yeah, those guys were friends. And I don't know the story of how Jeff first hooked up with them, but.
What a track.
Especially David Williams was there all the time. And him and I became personally really close. And then, of course, there was the Michael Jackson connection, you know.
Right.
He was Michael wouldn't do a record without David Williams. You know what I mean?
Really? Wow.
Yeah. I even think, Quincy sometimes, I think Quincy might have tried to replace, David would be on a demo of Michael's and Quincy would replace it with one of his guys. And when I say his guys, I'm talking about a Lee Ritenour, you know what I mean? Amazing studio player.
Right.
And Michael would be like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Williams had this certain feel, you know what I mean?
He had that funky strut, correct?
Billie Jean.
Billie Jean.
You know what I mean?
He
had a thing. And he traveled with them, with the brothers. I think he did several tours with the Jacksons, as their guitar player.
Yeah, now that track is so tight, that Don't Hold Back. Oh, man. Every time I hear it, it's like, oh.
They were great. They were
great.
Yeah,
man. Great stuff.
Yeah, remember when Toto was first starting out? That was kind of the tail end. Disco was still, you know what I mean? That's where a lot of the sessions that, guys like, especially my brother Jeff,
he played on a gazillion of them, right?
Yeah, well, they were still alive when Toto was first starting out in 1977 and 78,
Especially the Cheryl Lynn, Got to Be Real.
Dig it, I mean?
Yeah.
Dig it. Paige would be killing himself with us, and then when we all went to bed, he'd go down the hall and do Cheryl Lynn, make a hit record. Like, that's how on fire the guy was.
Unbelievable.
In those early days,
Awesome.
Just on fire.
And that's
fire.
How did she end up, Cheryl Lynn, on Georgie Porgie? How did that happen?
Just for that reason. David was working with her down the hall. He was making her record at the same time we were making Toto 1.
Logical to me.
You know what I mean? And so it was like, hey, we need a girl. And Paige is like, I got the one right here.
Absolutely.
It was that, you know what I mean? It was that obvious and that easy, you know?
Yeah, you guys played on, I'm sure you did Donna Summer stuff, correct? With Giorgio Moroder, am I right?
Not with Giorgio Moroder. He was kind of his own synth guy. I did Donna Summer stuff with Quincy. Now, my brother Mike actually played on, Mike did a lot of stuff with Greg Matheson, you know, Summer, when she did the whole MacArthur Park thing. You know what I mean? They did this, you know, what was it like, you know, a 20-page, you know what I mean? It was this ridiculous length chart that Greg Matheson did. That was all my brother Mike. He did a bunch of that stuff. I did the Donna Summer stuff that Quincy produced, which was after Thriller.
Right,
I think it was
right.
the first thing we did together after Thriller.
That's the album that Quincy produced, correct?
Yep, State of Independence. State of Independence.
The woman in me. That one also. That was another song. That album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one Quincy produced after Thriller. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, they had that single. I got my finger on the trigger. Love is in control.
Yeah.
Right.
Now there's a story. You know, there's a classic story of. I remember we were working, you know, we were right in the thick of working on Donna Summer's album, and I was all set up in there. And, you know, one night after we left, just Quincy getting together with James Ingram, you know, God bless him. Next morning I came in and Quincy was like, dig this. And he played me this tune, and it just, that demo, which, you know what? I actually have a copy of it.
Okay? Wow.
That demo, what they did with James singing, just kind of a rough, you know, rough lyric, but he definitely had the line finger on the trigger. And I think they called in Villengains to do bass, I think. It sure sounds like that. And did a drum machine or whatever. Anyway, that demo, and of course this is right in the middle while Quincy's working on Donna, right? So they adapted the tune. Yeah, because Rod Tepperton was involved too. They, you know, Donna was very religious at that time, or had become very religious. She was very reticent about the title, about the lyric. So I remember they, you know, she insisted on the verse lyrics were changed. The key of the song, of course, was changed so it was right for Donna. You know what I mean? It's what you do as a producer.
I heard that he would push her, right? Really pushed her to sing more like a challenger. Am I right?
Well, I don't know about those details. I know that Quincy, being the, you know, one of the jobs of a producer is to make sure a song is in the right key for the singer. You know what I mean?
Correct.
Sometimes you'll get a demo of a song and you'll love it, but it's like completely
it's in
the wrong key.
Wrong key.
You want the singer to sing it right where it's like where they're really pushing it just the right amount. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the key of the song is a huge deal to the production of the song. You know, Henley, they redid Boys of Summer because he wanted it up one half step from where it was, from where they recorded it. You know, they redid the entire song because he wanted it one half step up. You know, the key is crucial. Anyway, the point I'm getting at, though, is that the finished product, you know what I mean, was nothing like that original demo. It did not. The magic, this is me just speaking freely here, was for me, having heard that original James Ingram, you know, demo, it never came close to that. You know, that had this magic that I wish, you know, wished they would have gone back and finished it for James and he would have released it, you know.
Right.
Because he sang the shit out of it, you know.
Yeah, no, that album, if I recall correctly, it didn't really, you know, mesmerize people. You know, that album for Donna, it wasn't huge compared to her other stuff. So I agree with you, you know. It made some of an impact, but it wasn't huge, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I agree. I never heard that demo, but I don't really think she killed it, you know, like MacArthur Park's kind of stuff, you know. Or earlier stuff, you know, but whatever, it is what it is, you know.
Yep, that was that one.
Yeah, but I tell you, man, that to this day it just amazes me all the stuff that you guys have played on, and I'm just recently discovering It's just wow.
And a lot of Yacht Rock artists too. Had like Pablo Cruz, right? You're on Pablo Cruz, Bobby Caldwell.
Yeah, that was James Newton Howard. You know, James Newton Howard was very close with Bill Schnee, who produced them. That was like at a point, and see, here's a guy like James Howard who was always very capable on synthesizer, right? But he meets me, you know what I mean? And I would go just a little bit further than he ever wanted to go as far as going down rabbit holes. And he started using me on everything he did, you know, including Pablo Cruz, you know what I mean? And then that's how I met Bill Schnee. He knew of my brother Mike and Jeff. You know, he knew very well of them. But that's when I first started working with Bill, was James bringing me along to the session, you know.
Wow.
And Bobby Caldwell, Airplay, too, with
yep.
And then even Andre Crouch, I see you have a credit for Andre Crouch, which is oddly enough, last week we interviewed this kid from Norway, Ole Barud. He's fantastic. And they said his father, Arnold Barud, was really responsible for bringing Andre Crouch, or the awareness of Andre Crouch, to Norway.
No
but,
kid.
But you got to hear this kid. Yeah. I mean, we told him he's got to go to like do something at the Baked Potato or something, do a gig or something in L.A., and people will go nuts for him. He's doing
like I don't remember the how I got with Andre. You know what I mean? I don't know if he just knew me from some other work I had done and called me or what. Yeah. But, yeah, I did a lot of sessions in those days.
And that, Eddie,
it was really
Jude
a great
Cole,
time.
Too.
What's that?
Yeah.
He's a big fan of Jude Cole, and he's he's on two of Jude Cole's albums.
That's right.
Yep. That's amazing. So. Jude's amazing. Yeah.
Start the Car. Love that song. Oh,
yep.
What a great song.
So let's talk
song,
about
man.
More of Steve's stuff. Like, I mean, I love personally, like on a Toto album, there'll be that one little track that it was a Steve Picaro penned tune, and it just blows you away. Like Leah on Fahrenheit is a gorgeous, gorgeous tune.
Gorgeous.
I love
Leah.
And the little things on 14. We it's that same thing. You get that one track. It may be buried. It's not getting the airplay or the attention, but it is just slamming you. If you know music and you know you're just touched by a beautiful melody and chord changes, you do it every time. And Leah,
thanks. I would sneak one on there. That. You know, I would get one every once in a great while. And those would be the only, you know, the guys would David Page was so prolific. Year after year after year, he would show up with a huge batch of tunes. And Luke always had stuff. Bobby's always had stuff. So, you know, there was no deadline for me to write. And I was getting, you know, especially, you know, starting with Toto in those days, I was so into the synth thing. I was so trying to make the synths on Toto albums the best sense I could, and my songwriting really took a back seat. You know, I wish I had more stuff. I wish I had more stuff on there, but I'm really proud of those ones. You know, the fact
be.
Like on It's a Feeling, I get to have that London, you know what I mean, I get to have the London fill, you know, recorded at Abbey Road on my song, you know what I'm saying? It's it was so cool being able to have Jeff Picaro and those guys playing on it. You know, Lukather, what you could really see why these guys worked like they did outside, you know, in sessions. What Lukather would bring to the table on every one of my songs, taking it back, like the part he would come up with.
Oh, he's crazy.
It was a part that I'd never thought of in a million years, and it was like, it'd be like he'd been playing it for, you know, 20 years, you know, like, like it always was there, you know, and that was like every time on every one of my songs, you know what I'm saying? And Paige would be as enthusiastic about my songs as I would be, you know, as far as wanting to spend time with them and make them, you know what I mean? Making them as good as they could be.
Oh, man, I tell you, though, that little, the matchbox car with the wheel off.
Oh, thanks.
Man,
me and Allie Willis.
Ah, oh,
yeah.
Love that.
Thanks. No, I was, I'd been writing, and I've been really trying to up my lyric game, and this is when I was doing
great.
A TV show, and a guy wound up being a very close friend, Greg Sill, I'd been bitching to him about wanting to find lyricists to work with, and he said, you know, I know Allie Willis, and she lives down the street. You want me to give her a call? And I was like, I was always scared to work with people, especially someone who's a legend like that, who I hadn't met before or whatever. And Allie and I just hit it off. She was so much fun to work with. That was actually my line, but that's the thing. When you're working with someone good, when you're working with someone really good like that, they bring out your A game, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And even on Someday, Some Way, I mean, More Than I Can Take, that's all you. And the lyrics are seem very personal, very hard on your sleeve kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that was after losing Mike and Jeff. That was kind of easy. Yeah, you know what I mean? Just kind of... that was told. You know what I'm saying? You can't. Every song can't be written like that, or you'll be. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
They'll put you in a home.
Yeah, you're
in
a straitjacket.
Every song can't be, you know, that real. You know what I mean?
There's a lick. I mean, besides it, that, Mike Porcaro plays on "I'll Be Over You" towards the end, right, Joe? That we always like.
I think he's unsung. I'm a bass player, Steve, and I think he's so unsung. I mean, the bass magazines never really gave him a lot of coverage, but the stuff he does, like this on These Chains, on the seventh one, during that little interlude, he does this incredible descending line that gives me chills and goosebumps on my goosebumps every time.
You know,
as a bass
Mike
player
was just
really,
you know,
was great.
I was so spoiled because, you know, whenever I would write a tune, whenever over the years, and this is before Toto, this is after Toto, whenever I would come up with something I'd get excited about as far as a song went, my first phone calls were to my brothers. You know what I mean? Wow. You know, Mike would come over in 2 seconds and play a bass part. And that's why there's on my solo album, there's several. You know, there's only that one where the three of us brothers are playing, but there's several of Mike's bass parts because he was one of the first, before the song was finished, I had a Mike bass part on the verse and chorus, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then Jeff, even as much as we would bump heads in Toto, you know what I mean? We would bump heads big time in Toto when we weren't in such close proximity. And after I had left the band, he would do anything for me. You know what I mean? He would do anything for me. You know what I mean? You know, it was great. So those guys did every demo I ever did. You know what I'm talking about? Until I lost them. You know what I'm saying? So
we were sorry to hear that you lost your dad last year too. The great Joe Piccolo.
Yeah, that was a tough one. That was a tough one, man. But
I saw a credit for your dad. I saw a credit for your dad that he played on a Madonna album. Is that true?
Absolutely.
What did he do for Madonna?
He did something on a Pink Floyd record. Jeff brought him in on something. He did something uncredited on a Pink Floyd record too. That Jeff brought him in on the, I think on the wall somewhere. He did some field drum stuff. You know. If you saw the films that my dad was part of the orchestra on, especially stuff Jerry Goldsmith and, you know what I mean, that was, you know, percussion centric and working with guys like Lilo Schifrin, you know, or real early on, and just the classic movies that he was on, his
Ten Commandments,
his credits
and all that stuff
are just mind blowing, you know.
Yeah,
they're mind blowing. How many classic movies he worked on, you know?
Even the track for Enter the Dragon, right?
Yeah,
it's so cool.
Yeah,
it's so cool.
That was
man.
Lilo
yeah.
Schifrin.
I know.
That was Lilo Schifrin. You know, he did everything Lilo did. He was even when he had it. Lilo had his comeback and did those. What were those Brett Ratner movies with Jackie Chan and Chris?
Right. Oh yeah,
the comedian Chris. Yeah. I forgot his name.
Tucker.
It was
Chris Tucker, right?
Chris Tucker. There was three of them, and they hired Brett Ratner, being a big, you know, way into the, you know, movies, and you know, he kind of brought Lilo Schifrin out of retirement. Lilo still wanted his guys, and my dad was one of them. My dad was on all those dates.
Wow. Oh, that's great. Well, Steve, man, I tell you, you know, we can speak with you for hours.
Yeah.
You know, it's but
yeah,
I,
you know, we should in the future we'll narrow
say?
It down. We'll narrow it down to what we're talking about.
No, this was great. I mean, I'm sorry if it was all over the place, but it was just so much fun taking these little trips with you.
No, that's okay. And I'm sorry if I was all over the place.
No. We're
riveted.
Are you kidding me?
No. I'm so grateful that you've given us.
We don't want to waste your time.
Oh, easily.
You know, and it's hard to listen to stuff that long, too. You know, even stuff I'm real interested in, my favorite people in the world, I can only hear them, you know. Right. It's,
yeah.
You guys are asking me all these questions I know the answers to. You know what I'm saying? It's really easy.
I love that. That's right. I love that, bro. Well, Steve, man, what can I say? Thank you so much from my heart. This has been so special for Joe and I.
Yeah.
What can I say? Guys, meeting another one of my heroes. I love you, man. I love you.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you guys for keeping alive, you know, all this stuff we worked on and making such a big deal about it. Not only about our stuff, but, you know, all the heroes of mine that you interview and stuff. It's just what you guys do for musicians and there, as far as recognition goes, and I've gotten more than I'll ever deserve in a couple lifetimes, but especially a lot of our peers and friends and how you give these guys a place to be heard and interview them and stuff the way you do. It's really cool and really appreciated.
Well, it's really our pleasure.
I gotta tell you one thing before you go. Back in 86, I had a band that was very similar to Toto.
Oh, now, we did a showcase.
That. Yeah, I gotta share this with Steve. And we did a showcase at SIR Studios, and we had Chuck Jackson, the famous songwriter, and I forget his other partner, whatever. They were backing us up. Long story short, we had a bunch of A&R people come down. We killed it. George Mina was part of the band, and Joe, you were there, correct?
I was there. Yeah, I was too young to be in the band.
Right, you weren't in the band, but you were there.
Right.
And we didn't get signed, but one of the compliments, that somebody said to me at the end, like, you know, the band is great, but we don't need another Toto. I love that compliment.
Which was
today,
a compliment
today.
even though he didn't get a record deal, it's still a compliment.
Isn't that crazy? And it was an A&R from CBS. I don't know if it was Joe McEwen, one of those guys, I forget. But I'll never forget that. And what a compliment that is. No, we don't need another Toto.
even
if you kind of
want to pop your bubble, they might have meant that as a dig.
That's okay. Listen, now I forgot. Next time I hook up with Steve Lukather, we got to tell him I didn't get the chance, but I'm glad I got the chance to tell you. So yeah, man, right. What a compliment!
Very cool, man.
Right?
Very cool.
Well, Steve, man, listen, we'll let you go. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Great.
Thank
guys.
You.
Take good care. Okay.
All right.
You too, man.
Bye.
Be well.
Bye bye.
So, Joey.
Another great one, man. It was great talking to him.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't get around to talking about his soundtrack work. He did a lot of cool stuff. He worked on the TV sound, TV show Justified.
Uh-huh.
And then I wanted to ask him about, they did that, Toto did that Dune soundtrack back in the day. And
right.
I'm assuming he was the one that kind of got the bug for soundtrack stuff from that experience, I bet. I never got around to it, but those are definitely things to check out. He's to this day, I mean, you know, it's like he never stopped working since.
No.
He's still getting called to do stuff.
But we covered a lot.
Yeah,
we were all
over
the place. I love that. We were all over the place, you know. And Fahrenheit, and all the crazy stuff, all the production stuff that they did, all the sessions they did for other people.
Bug him with too much of the mundane questions that he gets.
Nah, right. That's why I'm, you know, we dabbled
stuff
a little bit. Right. I'm going to talk about the same old, you know.
Yeah,
but it was great, man. I tell you, another, you know, this is, I have to pinch myself. It's another one of my heroes.
We're blessed.
Right?
He's talking about
being
blessed. I feel blessed to be able to talk to these guys. It's really an honor.
It really is. It's awesome. And we're happy to bring this to you guys. I hope you enjoy it as much as Joe and I, you know. And we're going to keep them coming. Keep them coming. I've got another surprise for next week. And we'll see. We'll see where we go. You know, we're on a roll. We're on a roll.
All right. So with that, we'll say goodnight.
We'll say goodnight.
Episode of the Yacht Rock Show.
That's right. And Joe and I will catch you on the next show.
Yacht Rock Show.
Ah.
You've been listening to Eddie Gans on the Yacht Rock Show podcast. Thanks for listening. And tune in next week for more of your Yacht Rock favorites.